You're listening to All Things Cage at Waveform's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears, and I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust. My guest this week is Lawrence Wojtek, studio assistant to the celebrated American artist Robert Rauschenberg for some 25 years. Lawrence Wojtek is a man of many skills, all of which were put to extraordinary use by Rauschenberg. He is not a trained musician, but an inspired one, taking his lead very much from John Cage in his interest in noise and its potentialities when it comes to performance. This, coupled with his extraordinary engineer's knowledge of materials, has led him to create many musical instruments as well as artworks from equally extraordinary found objects. Lawrence and I will speak about his training days at RISD, his beginnings in the professional art world with Rauschenberg on Captiva Island in Southwest Florida, and about his deep appreciation of John Cage's life and work. We also speak about his own life in music, which has included his membership in the ensemble Sonic Combine, also known as the Robert Rauschenberg Studio House Band, with fellow musicians Kat Epple and Lawrence Getford. Sonic Combine is known for its artful assemblage of music and noise, its musicians performing on custom audio sculptures, synthesizers, world flutes, electronic wind instruments, and even a theremin. But Lawrence's music activities have also included the creation of Strategic Structures, a name given to both a series of musical metal sculptures built by Lawrence and spontaneous compositions that arose out of a 1989 live performance by musicians Kat Epple and Bob Stoll, husband and wife who formed the duo known as Emerald Web, and none other than Robert Rauschenberg himself, which took place late one night in 1989 at Rauschenberg's beach house on Captiva Island. As Epple recounts, it was a magical night, an inspired collaboration, and an exhilarating setting. So welcome to All Things Cage, Lawrence. It's so great to be with you.
Oh, I wish I could give you a big hug, Laura.
I just got it. It was virtual, but it was great. I just thought we would start. You aren't known to a lot of people in cage circles, and you should be. So let's start by you telling me a little bit about how you came to work with Bob Rauschenberg. You came to him straight from RISD. Is that correct?
True. I graduated in 82. My girlfriend, who I eventually married, Mary Sullivan, her mother had died in a car accident in Fort Myers. And she asked if I would help take care of the estate with her grandmother. And I drove from Rhode Island, all the stuff down to Florida. And when I was in, you know, I just left one of the coolest schools ever with all sorts of facilities. And I was going stir crazy in Fort Myers. I took a printmaking class at Edison Community College with Bob Peterson. And I walked into Bob's world and there were Lichtensteins and Rauschenbergs hanging on the wall. I just started to learn about Bob from Bob Peterson. So that's sort of how I got to be in Fort Myers. Bob Peterson was looking through my portfolio that I brought in. And at RISD, I did a lot of design courses. And so I fabricated and designed. I designed aluminum boats, a bicycle, just different things. And Bob looked at my portfolio and he said, "You know how to weld aluminum?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Bob Rauschenberg is looking for an aluminum welder." And Bob Peterson called up Bob Rauschenberg and they told me to drive out and talk to Bob. So that's how I got there in a nutshell, in a way.
That's amazing. You know, when I first met John Cage, it was kind of happenstance too. I didn't try to meet John Cage. And when we met at that first meeting, it turned out that I was very much what he was looking for. And that sounds like it's the same with you and Bob.
Well, the day that I met Bob was almost spooky. I had brought my portfolio that had slides and pages and stuff in it. Bob said, "Terry's going to give you the grand tour of the property. they had little bicycles, old bomber bikes, and Terry Van Brandt drove me around, showed me the print shop, the welding area, the studio. Bob had about 20 acres at the time. And then I came back up to the house and, you know, I've seen Bob in movies like The Skull Auction and different things. I knew his voice. And of course, I loved Bob dearly before I started working for him. I had an art history teacher. I take night school in high school, and this guy was a nut about Rauschenberg. This Bert Cherno at Housatonic Community College, Who You, we used to call it. He had a big beard. He'd smoke a pipe and blow smoke across the screen while he's showing his slides. And he had a night on Rauschenberg. And he said, he's the hardest artist to get, but if you get him, it's the best thing to understand. And so I was a Bob guy before I ever met Bob. And that first day with Bob, we go around and he's got my portfolio. He's looking at it on his little countertop in his old beach house. And he says, get yourself a drink. I opened the refrigerator and there was no beer. And I said, oh, I drink beer, Bob. He had wine and he was drinking Jack Daniels. And he said, here, go get some beer. He gave me a 20. And I raced on the bike to get a six pack. And I think if I told Bob I didn't drink, he probably would have kicked me out. But I came back and it was a gorgeous night. You know, the sun setting over the Gulf of Mexico. Bob's looking at my work and he was telling me things like, I knew you were going to show up and I need you to pull off my plans. And he looked at some of this, and I did this casting at RISD that was nuts, where I laid on the floor and I had a friend pack me in resin bonded sand and it set up like concrete. I was breathing out of a snorkel. And Bob said, you're a crazy fool. and he said, you know, this kind of stuff, you know, I'm really shocked that I found an artist that came out of an art school. He also said, I'm the only person that needs to know you're an artist. In some ways, Bob and I, you know, it was a true love story. I really loved helping him do whatever he wanted to do. To lose your ego, like, oh, I'm not great, to have somebody that, oh, this guy is so important. Everything he's doing is important. It just fit me like a glove. It was perfect.
I totally get that. That is indeed my own experience of Cage, that I was just so thrilled that I fit for him so beautifully, and to work in the service of his work. Was it really, I won't say a dream come true. I'm not sure I was thinking about that as a dream, but when it happened, it was exactly right. It was just exactly right.
There is something about when you know the person you're serving is the one.
It's interesting. For our listening audience, let me say that Bob Rauschenberg, I don't actually, Lawrence, you can tell me the year after I finished this little descriptor. But Bob had moved from New York City down to Captiva Island in Florida, which is a little barrier island in the southwest area. And it is truly one of the most idyllic, beautiful, natural spaces I've ever been to. And I've since, the very first time I met Bob personally was when I went to Captiva Island to give a talk at Edison College, where Lawrence first met Bob. And Bob was a treasured friend to Edison College. And Edison College, at the time, the gallery, the not yet called the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery, but just the Edison College Gallery, was run by a man named Ron Bishop. Mm-hmm. And Ron Bishop had done a very beautiful show with a little help from the John Cage Trust of Cage's visual artworks, and had invited me down to speak one day just to do this. And I simply called Bob Rauschenberg's office and talked to his then secretary, Bradley, and Bradley told him, and Bob just immediately arranged a taxi to pick me up. He put me up in his beach house, which was in fact where he and Lawrence first met. It was his first little property that he had bought. And then he proceeded to buy up as much of Captiva as he could, the northern end of it, at least. and gave me the use of a little BMW 2002 for my time there. He escorted me, he and Daryl, his partner at the time, he and Daryl escorted me over to Edison for my talk. And to make matters even more wonderful, in the course of my talk, I cheekily asked him to weigh in on something in this packed room, and he did. He just talked with me. It was absolutely lovely. And then we went to a bar afterwards.
Yep.
And had drinks. So anyway, that Edison College is in Fort Myers, which is adjacent. It's right over the causeway. It was really a wonderful experience. But back to you, Lawrence. When I first met you, which I believe was on that trip, mm-hmm. I was down there for not very long, maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 days. I couldn't even tell you what year this was, but it was certainly after Cage's death. And I want to say that from the moment I met you, you had a very, very interesting and deep experience of John Cage. And so this is not something that you got from me, but rather was already with you. Was that from your studies or was that from Bob, or was it kind of a mixture of the two? Bob and John were very close.
Yeah, well, when I was at RISD, I took a sound arts course, and the teacher had played a lot of Cage recordings that he had in his collection. And part of the sound arts course was that we were to take our recorders and record sounds. And like working in the foundry, sound is air movement. And we had this furnace that had a 5-horsepower blower that you would start up and then you would light it. And you want to talk about an incredible combustion of sound. And I also, at that time, we turned this on to Laurie Anderson and different stuff. I started making noise-making devices as somebody that just, new metals, new stuff. And I actually had a night in the foundry. It's called Nocturnal Noise Night. And I put flyers around the school asking people to make anything that made sound and bring it, then we'll have a noise. And so I liked that whole world. And when I started working with Bob, I don't know, there was a time when Merce and Bob and John had a little bit of a falling out, with Bob making so much money and they weren't making that much money. Calvin Tompkins talks about it in Off the Wall, where they needed something to get back from a tour in Tokyo or something. And Bob said, I guess I'll have to get my crayons out. And I guess there was some kind of a time period where they didn't. I was really into wanting to know everything about Merce and John when I started with Bob. And in some ways, Bob, when I first started working, he said, I want you to know all about me. I want you to know about my life. I want you to know how I make my art. And so I was very intrigued at where he learned these things. Bob was a collaborative artist, and he learned from the changers of the society, the people that changed the world. And he didn't want me to talk about Rauschenberg, how work was done, how things are made, while he was alive, because he didn't want people making Rauschenbergs. He didn't want competition. But he said that after he was gone, people needed to know how to learn how to do these things. And Bob, being a combine artist, he would combine the skills of all his teachers. Picasso says, bad artists copy, great artists steal. Bob soaked up stuff from everybody. And actually, your book, The Love Icebox, had put a lot of connections, because a lot of the letters were before Bob had met John. I think a lot of Bob's uniqueness came from his Eastern way of viewing the world and thinking about the world. And I think John was the one that really taught Bob a lot of that whole world in an intimate, close way. I think John said that he hated Rauschenberg because I've been trying to be Zen my whole life, and Bob was. What was happening in Western music and John with the percussions from Africa and things early on, I'm not a musicologist. I don't really as well study, but it just seemed like he was listening to the whole world rather than what Bach and Beethoven were doing on fancy pianos and violins. And Bob Rauschenberg, in some ways, what was happening in Western world with Albers and what Western art is and the history of Western art and what the future of modern art, Bob was more going with the whole world rather than just what the Western world was thinking. And I think that, you know, being curious about the whole world came from John Cage to Bob.
It's interesting, Lawrence. I mean, we can't really know, but what I can tell you is that one time I was asking John about Jasper Johns and Bob Rauschenberg, and I was asking him in particular, I had noticed that John and Merce both, to some degree, had a kind of a reverence for Jasper Johns. They walked on eggshells a tiny bit with regard to Jasper Johns. And I asked him something like, was he afraid of Jasper, you know, or what was that about? However he answered, it's not important. But what was important in this conversation is that I said, and Bob Rauschenberg, and John just visibly relaxed. And he said, oh, Bob and I are the same person. And I think that Bob felt that way about John as well.
You know, Bob is this loving, gregarious, crazy guy. And Bob really, really loved the world. He loved, it was almost kind of dangerous how much he loved things. Like just a small thing, if you were to endure one of Bob's sloppy kisses, Adele Lutz, who was married to David Byrne, Malou's their daughter, at Bob's memorial in LA had talked about getting a kiss from Bob was like getting a kiss from a St. Bernard that just drank a bottle of Jack Daniels. He really loved, he wanted, you know, he thought we all had to learn to live together. And he said, we also should learn how to play together. And the curiosity that he wanted to teach everybody how to come to their senses and all the senses like hearing, seeing, touching. He was a very Zen-like person. And it's funny because he thought of John as a very Zen-like person, as I taught. When we had the Tricia Brown Set and Reset opening at 381, Laurie Anderson was there, John Cage, Merce Cunningham, Jim Rosenquist. Before that party, Bob told me, sit near John and just watch how he's here. And so that night, you know, I sat near John and I was watching. And Laurie Anderson sitting next to John, kind of like John, like, I'm here. And they had all these wild stories being told by people like Jim. And it just seemed like being aware of everything is an important part of being here.
Yeah. Another thing that you touched on, I think that John was on to something very real when he said that he and Bob were the same person, in the sense that they both, for whatever reason, seemed to feel a kind of responsibility for the world, that they didn't see themselves as somehow separate or above or different. They were interested in all kinds of people. They were interested in what was happening in the world. I never forgot that first trip when I was down there. I think it was that first trip, but it could have been after. I came down frequently after that. But the day that I was there and the Dalai Lama had called. So Bob was on the phone with the Dalai Lama. And it was kind of like being around Cage, because he would have these conversations on the phone with the sort of people that I would otherwise probably never be in the same room with. And there was nothing different about his conversation with the Dalai Lama than there was with his conversation with me, for example. It was just a continuation from one human being to the next human being to the next human being. He was quite amazing and probably the closest thing to John that I had ever met.
What you said, you know, we all know Bob had a problem drinking too much. And a couple of times, I remember helping him get from the studio to the house. And I would be like his son saying, oh, Bob, you know, you shouldn't drink so much. You got to watch your health. It's not good for you. And Bob said, I do this for everyone because I have to find the answers for everyone in my art. It did seem like he was driven that his art was to help the world. It was to make life on this planet better, that we should evolve. And part of evolving is understanding everything.
That was precisely Cage's motivation behind composing with Chance Operations. It was to open up the possibility of new things, of a new way of thinking, opening up the imagination to something that you hadn't imagined before. And when the world either didn't respond or behaved badly, just in general, he took that on his own shoulders. It spurred him on to do something more, to do something else, you know, to just keep trying.
Yeah. I was with Bob on September 11th, and I saw the second plane hit the tower on his TV set next to him. And Bob said, I wish I could do something so positive it could erase this negative.
Mm, interesting. Let me stop you there because you just made me remember something about Bob. And that was that he had the television on every minute that he was awake, that the television was always on, not necessarily with the sound on. I commented on it because John Immerst had a television, but it was terribly small and it was relegated to the back room. Yeah. Because Merce was the only one who watched television. And so it was sort of Merce's room, this little tiny orange couch, hardly big enough for half of Merce, not to say not for his whole body, but he would be in there kind of folded up trying to watch his television. But Bob said, I remember he said that for him, the television was like another window. It was like having another window open.
It was like his eye on the world. And Bob wanted to witness what was going on all the time. And he wanted to see it right then and there if he could. And in his art, like when he wanted, you know, they say he had real things in his art. He wanted to include the world. When he was doing his transfers, he had all these magazines and he'd be cutting out all these pictures. And it was almost like he had the internet where all these photographers were out there showing him what was happening in the world.
Interesting.
He could grab something. And, you know, it's funny because Bob didn't like people reading into what they thought it meant. Somebody would say, oh, this Rolex watch means he's wealthy. You know, it's just a picture of a Rolex watch. And he wanted everybody to have their own feelings about what's happening right now by what's going on. And Bob, being quarter Cherokee, was really sensitive to nature. And he always said, watch what's happening. See what it's telling you things. I remember we were in Venice. He had the Quattromani show. And in one of the canals, there was a fish dying and it was swimming in circles. And Bob pointed it to me and we both looked at it and he said, he's searching for direction at the end of his life.
That's cute. Let me add that the television, lest anybody get the wrong idea, we're not talking about 12 hours a day of CNN. It was soap operas in the afternoon. And
Bob Ross.
It was really anything that happened to be on Channel 7 ABC that afternoon. And nobody was particularly paying attention to it. It was just another thing that you could gaze at, or it would become part of the visual landscape of the living room, along with the Gulf of Mexico outside.
Yes, yes. Oh, I mean, we had to, we saw Bob walking to the studio, we turned the TV on. You know, it had to be. And at one point, Terry Van Brunt mounted a really high-end Bose stereo with speakers all around up in the ceiling. And the first day Bob was in there, you could hear sounds from this corner, that corner. Bob said, turn it off.
Too much. It was too much.
Because Bob he had a way of noticing everything. And if in the studio, people talking, things going on, he watched, he saw, he just was aware of everything. He was just really, really tuned in on everything.
That's clear from his work, isn't it? I mean, really, when you get to know his work, it's clear.
Yep.
That's different, by the way, from Cage, because John was not really, he had a kind of oversensitivity to the world. So I'm not sure that, I mean, he didn't read newspapers, for example, or magazines. He didn't watch television. He didn't listen to the radio. He used the radio in compositions, but he didn't actually, he didn't let the world in that way. He let the world in through people that he met, through audiences, through performing in unusual places. But it wasn't the same way that Bob did, which was looking at the imagery of the world. Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Cage drank almost as much as Bob.
Well, there was many years where I tried to, and we had people that were helping, you know, we tried to make sure he ate good food. He had this woman at a health food store, Mary Horvat, tried to make sure that he had really good nutrients. It was one of those things I was told, you know, okay, Bob's an alcoholic, he's going to drink. Try to keep him so busy that he doesn't drink too much. We had tricks where we had certain bottles. He would try to drink a bottle a night almost, a Jack. And we would have other bottles that were lower down because you couldn't put water in the bottle.
Right. He would know. He would know anyway.
So we would kind of move a bottle up that was lower down and just things like that. And Bob was always checking. He would come back. And I think there was like fingernail marks on the labels always where it was like a little scratch where the level was.
He was keeping an eye on you.
Yes. Yes.
That's very funny. John, this is apropos that very thing. John used to drink a bottle of wine every night and he would have a hangover in the morning. He didn't really like that he did that. And so he started to use a magic marker and he would write a mark on the wine bottle where he could drink to, that he felt okay. And it was, you know, maybe about a halfway. And every day when I came to work, but the level of the wine was at the very bottom of the bottle. So he ended up in the end of his life not drinking at all for the last year because he developed a kind of psoriasis. And there was some proposition from some doctor that he was probably having an allergic reaction to fermented liquids. And that he was told by this doctor that he should avoid wine altogether because it was too complex and that he should drink single malt liquors like scotch. So John tried to do that for a while, but his heart really wasn't in it. So he did stop altogether. But like Bob, this is what I think. And you tell me if you agree or what, if you have an opinion. With Cage, when he stopped drinking, he was not happy. The weight of the world continued to be on his back, but it felt like he had no time off from that. There was no release, which I think was partly what the drinking was about, was just a break. It was a break from feeling the weight of the world. So that when he stopped drinking, he was somber. There was a real somber quality to him.
Well, I think I said there was something with Bob and alcohol and being quarter Cherokee. You know how people like Indians go wild when they have fire water. And Jack Daniels for many years was his gateway drug. He would lose his inhibitions at, I could tell like he would be coming into the studio and he would start to drink and then all of a sudden he'd start to think. He would be a focused attention and he would be getting into his mind. And for me, the rapid decision making, you know, I was very sensitive to his needs in the studio, how everything flowed, how he would build up to get things going. He was always seemed to be racing. It got to the point where acrylic paints dry too slow. So I bought these heat lamps and I made this this lamp that would lower over the paintings that had six bulbs on each one. So it drew a lot of wattage. And he said, I need another one. And so we had two of these made. And on a good night, he would do six or seven big paintings. One would be dry. He would do these explosions of color underneath, and then he would work on top of that, but it would have to be dry before he could work on top of that. And then if he silk screened over here, he had to dry that screen before we could do it on top another screen. And so it was this very long journey into all these worlds. And he always wanted something he had never done or never seen. And so new materials, new challenges, a painting in a new way. He was like trying to stay forever young by being someplace he had never been. I love the story that Bob told about John and him being lost in Manhattan. They're walking along and Bob just said, John, I've never been here. We're lost. And John said, isn't it wonderful?
He said that a lot. I remember one time being with him in an Asian market in Chinatown. And we were there to get some tofu. That's all they sold was tofu. Five different kinds behind a glass. And this store couldn't have been more than about 8 feet by 8 feet, really. And we were walked in and it was just packed with people, from Chinese people, all who live downtown, all of whom chattering at each other and getting ready and ordering their tofu. And I looked at John and he hadn't felt well for the last day or two. And I looked at John and I was full of dread because I thought, oh, this is too much for him. Maybe I should suggest that he go outside. I can wait in here. And while I was doing all of this in my head, I look back at him and he's looking absolutely beatific. And I said, it's very crowded in here or something like that. And he said, isn't it marvelous? But let me ask you a question. Were you saying implicitly in what you were just saying that for Bob, which is not the case for John, but for Bob, that drinking led him to a greater connection with his work?
Yeah, it was his gateway drug.
Right. For John, the drinking ceased the work. He couldn't work.
Oh no.
He only drank after 6 o'clock at night, always. He would never drink before six. Whereas Bob always had a drink in his hand when I was around, always.
Yeah. No, when Bob was working, and then when he did go to Betty Ford and he went through it, he came back and his new drug was caffeine. He got all these espresso makers. He used to call them hot shots. And he drank a lot of hot shots. He talked about he misses, you know, just the feeling of, I do think there was some sort of strange connection with physical nature of his body. You know, they talk about corn and the development of corn in North America and the Indians, and they started with these little, and it spread all over the place. And then Jack Daniels was a corn whiskey. It almost seemed like it was rocket fuel for this shaman that was developed, you know, through the years, the kind of thing.
You know, Lawrence, I think that I remember Cage telling me something to the effect that all of his painter friends were drinkers because it was very easy. You're home all day, so you can have a drink in one hand and a paintbrush in the other hand. You know, that it kind of was a rhythm that they did. And a lot of artists that I've known have also been drinkers. You know, even the generation after Bob and after John's all took up drinking, in part because they were home and it freed their minds. It freed their inhibitions to work in perhaps more creative ways. Whereas for Cage, it was the opposite. He would pass out. He would just pass out. So he would only drink at night where he could do that safely.
Well, this is a little funny side note. Joseph Albert is at Black Mountain College. Bob went there seeking knowledge. And in some ways, Albert was his best teacher because Albert's taught all the rules of what fine art is and what really matters, and then all composition and all this kind of stuff. And Albert's was a very spiritual, Catholic focused guy. And he believed that you have to have purity of spirit to produce fine art. And I read later on a thing that Albert wrote when he was at Yale, and they asked him what he thought of the art that was happening. And this was like in the 70s. So this was when Bob was really big and stuff. And he said, what do you think of modern art today? And Albert said, it's made by a bunch of drunks.
Wow. Wow. So there's something to be said. I could talk about this with you for hours, but we're going to run out of time. I want to talk with you a little bit about Sonic Combine. Who are your co-musicians in that band?
It's Laurie Getford and Kat Epple. Kat Epple was in a band, Emerald Webb, with her husband, Bob Stoll. And early on in the 80s, they had moved from San Francisco to Fort Myers. They got a grant to do some albums. They had quite a few albums out, CDs. And the grant, Kat said, it was enough to live for a year in Fort Myers, where her mother was, or a month in San Francisco. And so they thought that they would set up a studio and start working. They did play some local places, and I met them and loved what they were doing. I bought their CDs. I decided to introduce them to my wild and crazy boss.
When was this, roughly?
The 80s, 87, something around in there. Bob had won the Grammy Award for the Talking Heads CD in 83. It designed the albums. And actually, for me to get into the band and start doing stuff, with the Strategic Structures album, which Bob Rauschenberg plays with Kat and Bob, they had this really cool project where they knew someone that was dealing with someone that had a decommissioned Russian nuclear missile that they were going to cut up for scrap metals. And they were wondering if they could make musical instruments, kind of like beat your plowshare into a sword or something like that.
That's fantastic.
And I said, yeah, you know, I could work with that. They came to the studio with Bob was doing works on brass, bronze, and copper at the time. And I had also some titanium, some different stuff. And they were like rapping and banging on stuff and listening to it. And Bob gave them permission to make these instruments with me, with his materials and his stuff. And I happily was making them. This harkened back to stuff that I was doing at RISD. But it was a little bit more advanced because they were putting contact mics and they knew how to process the sounds. And so they would get something and then they'd mix it in with their audio and they play on top of it. And so I was totally thrilled about these metal experiments. And it's funny because as a designer that makes structural things, if I make an aluminum space frame object and everything is under tension, it gets really, really strong. When I start hitting these components, you can almost tell the quality of the tension and the quality of the weldments on how its structure really works. Without doing, you know, structural test and damaging it, you can just tell by the way it is. And so it just tied into everything that I was doing as a fabricator. And so at one point I was making stuff already and I was playing it at little venues and I had a really unsuccessful solo career for quite a while. And Kat heard me at one of these performances and I had made a machine that made noise and I was making noise while it was making noise. And I made it out of one of those electric knives that goes back and forth real fast, and I connected it to metal pipes and I had a little drum and it hit it and I could turn a knob on how fast it would do it. It sounded like just a bunch of noise. And Kat said, I'd like to play with you. And so she kind of got me into, okay, we'll play. Laurie Getford was working with me and Bob, And Laurie was in bands. He played with people when he was in Tallahassee. He played keyboards. He was a nut about Hammond organs. He had a few of them. He would buy them and rebuild them. Tom Petty, he played with. He played with real people at real times. So the genesis of us playing together just kind of happened. I made a lot of stuff out at Rauschenberg Studio, and I'd explain to Bob, oh, I wonder what this would sound like. And Bob would be like, oh, I can't wait to hear it. And so I would make something and play it. And I could keep it out in Captiva. And Bob had this really big studio near the end, and I had a bunch of instruments. And often I would play by myself at night. I'd slep them into the room and play. And there was this policeman that lived on the property. And this one night, the next day, he said, I thought I heard a whale dying last night.
That's so funny. So for Strategic Structures, Strategic Structures was both the name of the instruments, but also the name of the kind of piece that the three of you did. You, Kat, and Bob.
And Bob.
And yeah. Bob Stoll.
Yeah. The Strategic Structures was the CD that they produced that was 17 minutes long. And that was, we made the instruments. Bob and Kat explained to Bob that they were going to bring all the recording gear out. And they did it in Bob's old beach house, in that little kitchen area. They brought everything out there. They set everything up. Bob Rauschenberg noodled around on the three instruments for a little while just to get comfortable. But he's the one that's playing those objects. And Kat and Bob Stoll were playing their instruments. And it was a jam session, like 17 minutes long. Bob was drinking at one point. I can tell when he's banging his glass of Jack Daniels against the big brass instrument.
You named these instruments, or two of them, right? There's George. And what's the other one?
George and Gracie and Bo. They were named by Bob and Kat Stoll.
Kat Apple.
Because they were living with them, they were playing with them, and they continued to use them, and they were their property, their baby.
Bob loved this?
Oh, he had the best of time. This was after he had won the Grammy for the album cover. He said, John Cage will kill me if I get a Grammy for this.
I was just going to say that when I gave that talk on John Cage's visual artwork at Edison that Bob Rauschenberg so kindly sat through, he told me over drinks in the bar that he had no idea that John Cage was such an accomplished visual artist. And I realized when he said that I think, well, I can tell you that John Cage was a little shy about the fact that he had had the nerve to encroach upon Bob and Jasper John's domain. By being a composer and then making visual artwork. And I wonder if that was also true for Bob with regard to his music. But I think that didn't happen until after John was dead. Is that true?
Well, Bob made music for dance pieces all through the years when I was there. And it was almost like Picasso said, he was trying to learn to paint like a child. Bob liked the idea of making music like the baby at a piano. And he would make noise, like Tricia Brown would have a piece coming up and she'd say, Bob, would you do something? And he would do something. One of the funniest things, I had bought a really good cassette recorder. It was a Sony Walkman, like $300. And I had a special microphone. And Bob asked if he could borrow it. He was going to do something for Tricia. And they had this old piano outside his old studio. And the next day when I came to work, the microphone, the end of it was almost rubbed off.
Really?
The piano keys had like lines all up and up. I never heard.
He was rocking out in the middle of the night.
I never heard what that was. But we would be making stuff and he would come walking in with a microphone. And one time he had this note and it said, Lawrence, don't say anything. and he's walking around with his microphone. And so I hung that on my wall. You know, there's lots of time, like in 381, late at night, he would grab a water bottle and start rubbing it against the radiator. And, you know, people would start hitting pots and pans, and Sashka would run out of the room. And, you know,
well, this is another way that he and Cage were alike, you know, in that John, you know, really started his career by being a percussion composer, and he believed that everything had inherent noise in it, that all you had to do was rub it or engage with it in some tactile way, and it would reveal itself. It would reveal that. And I'm quite sure that he talked to Bob about that. I'm sure of it. Anyway, yeah. We have to wrap up because I want to be able to leave enough time for us to play some of Strategic Structures. You did not play on Strategic Structures?
No, I wanted to, you know, I was the noise making device maker. So that was,
of course, wouldn't have happened without you, Lawrence. It was a pleasure to talk today. I hope we can do this again.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to giving you a big hug. The last time I didn't want to hurt you when I saw.
Thank you. That was very kind of you. I'm much more sturdy now.
It seems to me that Bob learned so much, and it was like permission to be who Bob wanted to be. Early 1951 is when Bob met John Cage, and he talked about, he did envy John and Merce's relationship. And he's, in some ways, he wished he had such a true love. It, almost having permission to love the world, love life, and art can make this world better. I think a lot of that came from John to Bob.
It's nice to hear, Lawrence. I'm sorry that he didn't live long enough to read Love Icebox, which is only to say, to see that early correspondence from Cage to Merce, where John revealed himself as the loving person that he was.
Oh, I think he would have really loved it. You know, I think, love is never having to say, I have nothing to say, and I am saying it.
Thank you, Lawrence. We'll talk again.
Take care. Love you.
I love you. Bye.
We've talked a bit about Strategic Structures, but before we listen to an excerpt, let me tell you a bit about the structures themselves. Wojtek constructed these using a variety of materials, including aluminum, Belgrade brass, steel, and both elemental and alpha-beta weapons-grade titanium. In physical form and appearance, each has the qualities of integral strength and beauty and are stripped bare of superfluities. Electronic audio processors are incorporated into each structure, color, finely tune, and amplify the rich timbres generated by these exotic metals as they are bowed, plucked, struck, and stroked. Each instrument has its own musical personality, name, and unique set of performance parameters. Each was, in fact, affectionately named George, Gracie, and Beau. As is stated in the liner notes to the CD, strategic metals are often used by the military-industrial complex in the design and manufacture of new destructive bombs and other weapons devices. It is the artist's hope that by embracing positive, alternative, and artistic uses for these materials, perhaps others might be encouraged or inspired to wage peace through art.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.